I am speaking to you at a moment of grave crisis.
I'm Jeff Turner, and this is Recall. It's a series about history. Not the ancient past, but history that's still hot to the touch. In this first season, I explore a revolutionary political movement that brought a modern democracy to the brink. You can find Recall, How to Start a Revolution, on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens, the podcast edition. Tonight,
canceled culture. The Just for Laughs Comedy Festival says it is seeking bankruptcy protection. Comedian Mark Critch tells us the loss for audiences and performers is no laughing matter.
Cruelty confirmed. UN experts who visited Israel say there are reasonable grounds to believe that sexual violence took place during the October 7th attack.
A non-running start after the U.S. Supreme Court rules that only Congress can prevent Donald Trump from running again. Democratic Congressman Jamie Raskin tells us he got right to work.
Gas highlighting. A new satellite will track where methane emissions are coming from in the hopes of getting a handle on the damaging greenhouse gas.
No rest for the wikier. Hundreds of hours later, a researcher in the UK completes her personal mission to give women a bigger presence in the world's biggest free online encyclopedia.
And you cannot spell spiffy without SPF. The state of Vermont is considering a truly progressive change to its constitution, which would make it legal for kids to apply sunscreen at school. As it happens, the Tuesday edition, radio that suspects some kind of protection racket. The Just for Laughs Comedy Festival helped launch the careers of the likes of Norm Macdonald, Kevin Hart, Amy Schumer, and Ali Wong, among dozens of others. It's where Rowan Atkinson made one of his first appearances as Mr. Bean, and the hidden camera pranks featured in the Just for Laughs gag series were a frequently baffling mainstay of so many Canadian childhoods. For decades, the festival has been a mainstay also of the cultural scene in Montreal. And when St. John's-born comedian Mark Critch performed there in 2017, he didn't spare the host city any slander.
Because Montrealers, you can be a little, on behalf of the rest of the country, you can be a little whiny, you know? You're always whining about how distinct you are.
We're distinct. We're different. We're distinct. We're more fun than Saskatchewan.
Yeah, who is it, you know?
Mark Critch making fun of Montrealers back in 2017. Today he's thinking of them after the news that the festival's parent company is seeking bankruptcy protection. Management has laid off 75 people and says its 2024 Montreal Festival is canceled. Mr. Critch says that is terrible news for comedy. We reached Mark Critch in Halifax.
Mark, what do you remember about performing at the festival in Montreal?
Well, it's, you know, a Montreal crowd, and there's nothing quite like it. They're the warmest audiences in the country, and they're very respectful of artists, of even of stand-up comedians. So they're the best, but there's nothing like that Just for Laughs stage. You go out there, many careers have been made on that stage, and it's nerve-wracking beforehand. It's a big opportunity. You're full of nerves. You feel like you're going to pass out. Then you walk out there and you see those big smiling faces, and somehow you know everything's going to be okay. So it's the best adrenaline rush in the world.
So, and I'm sure you spoke to other comedians there as well. As you said, it's a fertile ground to break careers, also bring in big, huge names come, but it helps break comics as well. What did you hear from newer comedians about that opportunity?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, I myself, many years ago, started off writing for the galas for people and writing for the TV show as well. And I would sit there, you know, kind of watching, hoping one day you get on the stage. And it's a great opportunity, not just the huge Just for Laughs gala shows. But also, the festival itself is peppered with different venues, different types of shows. There might be kind of raunchier shows. There are theme nights. There everything you can imagine. So there's so many stages to get on there to see other. It's like a convention for all comedians. You get to see who's around. You get to see who you might work for, and people get to see you, and it leads to great work. So that would be the great thing about it. You get to see huge acts that you would never get a chance to see, and you get to perform alongside them. Mm-hmm. So it's very fertile ground for comedians.
So when did you find out? How did you find out today's news?
This morning I was checking Twitter, and there it was. And I was absolutely shocked. I mean, it's the biggest comedy festival in the world. It's such a Canadian thing, too, you know, and so proudly Canadian. That it's like Air Canada going under or something like that. And I know they'll be back because they certainly feel the need to get this going for all our comedians and all our audiences. And, of course, all of the millions of dollars in spinoff industries, mm-hmm. the hotels and the bars and all that as well. Yeah. But I was completely shocked. I had no idea.
I think a lot of people were. And, you know, given that the shows do attract such big audiences and big name performers, sold out usually. So how do you think something like this happens? Because it looks like a big success.
It's that show business, though, isn't it? I know, but I think it's a giant. I don't think people realize how big that organization is. You know, it's the festival, it's all the spinoffs, it's television shows based on that. It's a million different things, festivals all around the world. So maybe it's a case of getting a little bit big, bigger than they could handle. But also coming out of a pandemic, I mean, show business had as hard a time as anyone, if not harder. There's one thing you need for a comedy show, and that is audiences. And the comedian needs them to feed off, but the festival needs to feed off them as well. So I think they've been working really hard, with a lot of hats on, trying to keep this thing going. And unfortunately, it seems to have gotten away from it for the time being, but I'm sure that it will be back again.
The president of Just for Laughs, Bruce Hills, spoke with CBC Radio back in 2013. And even at that time, he was hinting at some of what you were getting at just there about the changes in the comedy landscape. And of course, that's well before the pandemic and all of the other things we're seeing now. But let's listen to some of what he said in that conversation.
Really, at the end of the day, the funny thing about it is that, you know, people like Funny or Die are knocking our door down to be a partner at Just for Laughs because they want to be able to be on the ground as well. You know, at the end of the day, nothing beats live. While that is the case, in our view, we are out there doing digital deals across the board. You know, we have our own YouTube channel that we're in the midst of negotiating. So we can have a platform there as well and also find ways online with the comedians that are important to our festival to have a role not only online but also on stage.
Is that digital piece, do you see that having a bigger impact on live performance? Because it seems to me that people are going to live shows when they can, but are you seeing and hearing differently?
Well, I think coming out of the pandemic, people's the way they live their lives has changed, you know? And I think maybe comedy is one of those areas that's been a little slower to come back than others. With the festival, too, I mean, you'll see those shows packed, but there's a lot of costs with that festival and, you know, government coming in as a partner as well. And when you talk about some of these, you know, different digital platforms, you need to create more, you need to have more, you need to have more product. It needs to be, you need to feed a lot of mouths, entertainment wise. So it may have been a case of just having too many mouths to feed at once. And maybe it's a case of scaling back and getting back to the heart of the festival. But I do know that, I mean, Bruce Hills is not only the best person and one of the best people in comedy, but I think he's one of the best people to lead a company in Canada. So I really, you know, I am sure Bruce is working harder than ever with the team there to make sure that there is one in 2025.
The company says it hopes to come back in 2025. You've said you feel that it will absolutely come back. But in the meantime, what would you say to those young comics who were hoping to be scouted or get a break and be on that JFL stage?
I mean, it's a dream. I mean, I tell you, there's nothing like it. And having that JFL name next to your name on a poster is a real kind of it's a stamp. So the audience will see that and they'll go, oh, this guy must be good. He's been to Just for Laughs. But you will be. And a lot of comedians, I mean, a lot of comedians do these showcases. They hope very much to get on there. They didn't get it this year, they'll get it next year. They didn't get it this year, they'll get it next year. I have faith there will be another year, and those acts will be there, and they will be showcased by Just for Laughs, and they'll become household names. It's just going to have to wait another year.
Mark, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Mark Critch is a comedian best known for his work on Son of a Critch, and This Hour Has 22 Minutes. We reached him in Halifax. Today, Donald Trump's name was on the ballot in all 15 Super Tuesday primary states, including Colorado, which was one of three states that had tried to keep the former president from running, alleging that his actions on January 6, 2021 amounted to insurrection. But yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled unanimously to keep Mr. Trump on the ballot, reasoning that it was the job of Congress, not individual states, to enforce the anti-insurrectionist 14th Amendment. Now, Maryland Congressman Jamie Raskin took that note and has since announced that he intends to do just that, and he already has new legislation in the works. We reached Jamie Raskin in Washington, D.C.
Congressman Raskin, Donald Trump's name was on Super Tuesday primary ballots today. The Supreme Court decision yesterday made that happen. So, you know, how are you feeling about introducing this legislation right now? Is it even possible to pass legislation to keep Trump off the ballot in November?
Well, the Supreme Court decided that the states could not block someone from the ballot if they're running for federal office. And so the legislation that I've got creates a process whereby the Attorney General of the United States or a citizen in a private right of action can go to federal court in Washington, D.C. and assert that someone is disqualified because they participated in an insurrection or a rebellion. At that point, there would be fact-finding, due process. There would be a hearing, and either the court would reject the claim and say there was no insurrection or he hadn't been involved in it, or they would determine that there was an insurrection and he had incited it, which was essentially what the House of Representatives determined when it voted to impeach Donald Trump on January 13th.
Is this a tool for the future? Or to be clear, do you see any real hope of keeping Donald Trump off of the ballot in November?
Well, it's both. It's a tool for the future, and it would apply to people like Donald Trump who just participated in an insurrection on January 6, 2021. But there would be a judicial process that would engage in fact-finding. And that's all the American people have really been demanding all over the country, whether it's in Colorado or Maine or Illinois. People are simply asking that the very plain language of the Constitution be enforced. It's a super narrow principle that's embodied in our Constitution.
Do you anticipate that Speaker Mike Johnson will even let this come to a vote, let alone eventually pass in the House?
Well, he's very much in the pocket of Donald Trump at this point. Unfortunately, like most of the MAGA Republican Party now. But when we voted to impeach Donald Trump for inciting an insurrection against his own vice president and the Congress and the Constitution, there were 10 Republicans who joined the Democrats. And then when we got over to the Senate side during the trial, there were 7 Republicans who joined all the Democrats in voting to convict. So there have been at least a small minority of Republicans who have been willing to elevate their constitutional oath above their fidelity to Donald Trump.
Are you concerned, Congressman, though, that by focusing on this, that this is just engaging in further tit-for-tat politics and not focusing on, you know, making sure your candidate is the best one and that voters are on side with Democrats, you know, fighting your political opponent, Donald Trump, in different ways? Would that not be more effective?
I don't believe in an a la carte constitution. I don't think we pick and choose which parts of the Constitution we want to enforce. And this is a significant constitutional principle opposing insurrectionism in high office. So my belief in the rule of law and our Constitution lead me to say that we need a process to make this real if the Supreme Court is going to punt and abdicate its own responsibility to enunciate what the law is. And I'm willing to stand by the rule of law, unlike Donald Trump, who has been losing cases and then denounces the judges and denounces the courts as corrupt and biased against him. I'm willing to stand by what the courts do, and I disagree with the Supreme Court's opinion here, but they've said it's up to Congress, and so Congress needs to act.
So close to the election, though, do you worry that I hear what you're saying about the rule of law and the Constitution not being a la carte in your view, but at such a critical time where you've got to get voters on side, well, could you or should you be channeling your energies elsewhere?
It's precisely because it is a critical time that we've got to stand up for the Constitution and the rule of law.
Are you concerned if you look down the line into the future that a future Congress might abuse these powers and keep legitimate candidates from being able to run for office?
Well, of course. As we've been seeing in our country for several years now, people can get into high office and abuse the law in a lot of different ways. But we swear an oath to the Constitution, and we should all be acting however we can to defend the Constitution and defend our democratic institutions. But the claim that I've been hearing that there would be violence if he were kept off of the ballot cannot be used to nullify the rule of law. I mean, we're talking about a provision that was put into the Constitution to prevent violence and insurrection against the Union. And what a surrender that is to violence and insurrection to say we won't enforce it because somebody might get violent.
And just finally, Congressman, before we let you go, you know, there are voters who'll say, why not just let me decide whether I want to reject Donald Trump as a presidential candidate in November?
There are more than 100 million people who've been disqualified from the presidential ballot. You have to be 35 years old. If you're not a born U.S. citizen, you can't run. So Jennifer Granholm, who was born in your country, she's the Secretary of Energy and was governor of one of our largest states, Michigan. She can't run for president. We've got lots of people who are disqualified for president. Barack Obama can't run for president because he's already served two terms. If you think about all of these forms of disqualification for the presidency, the one that is most defensible and affects the least number of people is the one that excludes from the Oval Office people who tried to overthrow the Constitution of the United States.
Congressman, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you much. I appreciate it.
Congressman Jamie Raskin represents Maryland's 8th District. We reached him in Washington, D.C. There are something like 6.7 million entries on Wikipedia, according to Wikipedia anyway. And of course, we've all been warned against using it as a source in our research papers, but it's undeniably the first stop for curious minds who want to understand string theory or the personal life of John Stamos. Now, Wikipedia's popularity as a source is the reason Lucy Moore was determined to ensure that a bigger portion of those 6.7 million articles were about notable women. Ms. Moore is an archaeology researcher at the University of York, and since 2021, she's been working to make the world's biggest free encyclopedia more representative, specifically by adding at least one entry about a woman from every country in the world. We reached Lucy Moore fresh from completing that task in Leeds, England.
Lucy, at last count, how many Wikipedia entries have you written?
563.
How many hours of work have you put into this?
I haven't kept count, but the fastest I've written a biographical article for a woman is an hour. So a conservative estimate would be 563 hours, but I suspect it's a lot more.
Did you realize when you took this on how big of an undertaking it would be?
I don't think I mean, I don't think I really thought it through, I'll be honest. I had been editing for a while, and I realised I'd written pages for about kind of women from about half the countries in the world. And I thought, oh, I'll do the other half, you know, so it's fair, so it's equitable.
And most countries had entries for women, right?
Yeah, yeah. There was no country that had no article about a single woman. But women are underrepresented on all language Wikipedias, apart from Welsh, because they, as a language community, made a really concerted effort to ensure that they had gender parity. But particularly on English Wikipedia, there's less than 20% of the biographies are about women. Mm-hmm. So although there are biographical articles about a woman from every country already, it's not a representative selection of the populations.
Which countries proved to be the most challenging?
The Vatican was quite hard, perhaps unsurprisingly. More generally, countries where women are less prominent in public life, they're more challenging because women are written about less, even less, I should say. So you have to look harder for sources to support the article. The last thing you want to do is write an article about a woman and have it be deleted. So you really have to ensure that you've got the right supporting material, mm-hmm. That shows that she's, you know, notable enough to be included.
And did you find one for the Vatican in the end?
Yes, I did. Yes.
Who was it?
She's a member of the judiciary. I can't remember her name off the top of my head. How embarrassing.
Well, you've done more than 500 entries. I can forgive you.
Yeah.
One of the entries you wrote was about Julia Chin, someone you've said that, that you were surprised to find did not have a page. Tell us about her.
Yeah. So Julia had a really interesting life. So she was an enslaved woman who was owned by the vice president of the US, Richard Mentor Johnson. But from the sources that are available, it appears that he treated her very much as his wife, that she ran his estate at home, and they had two daughters together. And I was really surprised because I thought, you know, it's the vice president of America, you know, with this extraordinary woman by his side, living in an incredible time.
It's great that you've taken this on, done all of these entries, hundreds of them. But what do you think should and could be done to correct what appears to be bias in this platform?
Well, so Wikipedia itself, you know, the Wikimedia Foundation, who are the charity that support it, you know, they recognize that there's bias in the content. But as editors, people like me, you know, we can only write articles based on the research that's been undertaken. So we need more research from academics, from journalists, from people, you know, kind of who it might be working independently to build up a body of more and more material about women. Mm-hmm.
So more research so that it can then find its way to Wikipedia. But you've also said there need to be more women who sign up to be wiki editors.
Yeah, absolutely. Women are underrepresented on in the editing community. I think it's difficult to know the figure, but it's less than 20% of women contribute as editors to Wikipedia. And I think it's really important that women do this. You are always often drawing on your own experience of the world whenever you do anything. So if only a fifth of the people who are contributing to Wikipedia have, you know, the experience of being a woman in the world, then things are going to be missed. There are huge gaps, for example, for women's health, particularly like medicine, on Wikipedia, or the coverage is scant. And there are people who are working to address that. But it is really important because Wikipedia is the first place that we often go to. You know, if you're doing, you know, Dr. Google, you know, you might go to a hospital, but you'll go to the Wikipedia article. And if that entry isn't, you know, informed and useful for you, whatever the topic, beyond medicine, you know, then it's something that's really important to make sure it's right.
Have you heard from other women since news of your writing has made headlines?
Yeah, I mean, lots. Everyone, you know, is being very supportive. I think lots of my friends, and not just my women friends actually, have sort of said, you know, yes, thank you so much for doing this. Thank you for doing this. One friend messaged me and said, thank you for doing this, not for me, but for my baby daughter, which definitely made me shed a tear.
Oh, it made you emotional. One entry we noticed that is not there is a Lucy Moore entry on Wikipedia. Were you tempted to get in there and change that?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. I don't think I'm notable for Wikipedia, but also the guidelines are very much against you writing your own article. So I would not do that. No way. No way.
The highest of ethics. Highest of Wiki ethics. Lucy, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Lucy Moore is an archaeology researcher at the University of York and Wikipedia editor extraordinaire. We reached her in Leeds, England. Not that long ago, we thought the sun was a safe, fun friend. You look like you got some sun, we would say enviously to a friend whose skin was charred to the point where they whimpered every time the breeze gently caressed them. And before we went out in the summer, our parents would grease us up with tanning oil to ensure we would reach that coveted fried chicken level of crispness. But now, of course, we realize that it's fine to be sun-kissed, but the kiss should be an affectionate peck and not sloppy Frenching. So we need sunscreen reapplied frequently. Yet some places haven't got around to acknowledging that the sun is now our frenemy. Places like Vermont. Right now, Vermont lawmakers are considering a groundbreaking bill. S-187 would make it legal for students to take sunscreen to school and apply it when necessary. That does sound odd, but does not sound revolutionary until you hear that as of now, legally, students in Vermont need a doctor's note if they want to use sunscreen, and that, when they need to apply it, they have to go to the nurse's office. Vermont isn't even the only state with that policy. To be clear, it exists because the FDA classifies sunscreen as an over-the-counter drug, and the policy applies to all over-the-counter drugs. But it's not like overuse is a problem here. Sunscreen is not like a laxative. So let's hope this new bill passes, even if, and I'm not kidding, students would still need parental permission to use sunscreen at school, which is still odd, but at least means Vermont is moving closer to this solar system.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart MacLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
Since the attack on Israel on October 7th, there have been reports by the media and NGOs of systematic rape and sexual violence that took place that day. Now, United Nations experts who visited to try to verify those allegations say they are founded. Here's Parmila Patton, the UN Secretary General's Special Representative on Sexual Violence in Conflict.
There are reasonable grounds to believe that conflict-related sexual violence, including rape and gang rape, occurred during the 7th of October attacks in at least three locations, namely the Nova Music Festival site and its surroundings, Road 232, and Kibbutz Reim.
United Nations Representative Parmila Patton. Her team also found, quote, clear and convincing information, unquote, that hostages taken to Gaza have been attacked sexually and said such abuse is likely still taking place. The UN experts said that because an array of fighters took part in the October 7th attack, it could not determine who was responsible. Hamas leaders have denied the accusations. The UN report also cited allegations that Palestinians detained by Israel have been sexually abused. Orit Tsilitsianu is with the Association of Rape Crisis Centers in Israel. We reached her in Tel Aviv. And a warning, this interview is disturbing.
Orit, that kind of acknowledgement, and that acknowledgement coming from a UN investigation, what might that mean to the survivors you've spoken with?
This acknowledgement is actually the first time in the world that an international organization acknowledged that these things indeed happened. When you live in Israel and you saw what happened and you talk with the people, I think people in other places in the world don't exactly comprehend what we have passed, you know, waking up in the morning and having terrorists enter the houses, raping brutally, burning, mutilating genitals, cutting off limbs, and I don't want to continue because it's too graphic and too cruel. You know, I live in Israel, but I have friends all over the world, and I hear from many people that there is a denial of what has happened in Israel. And for me, as a woman, first of all, as a feminist, it's very, very sad. So I'm really glad that Pamela Patton did this report, and I have met with her and her team, and I met very dedicated and professional women. And because I work as the executive director of the Association of Rape Crisis Centers, I have some information which is, of course, confidential, and I try to help as much as I could.
Obviously, it is confidential, but what are you able to share about the kinds of things you've heard and were able to tell the UN?
So, my work and all of my colleagues' work is really dedicated to help victims and survivors in Israel. We never, never, never dreamt in our lives that we will have to deal with sexual crimes used as a weapon of war. You know, it's devastating, it's unbelievable, it's horrific, and it's sadistic. I read the report, and as I said, I helped her, and I can say what I can say to you and to your audience is that in Israel today, there are women who survived sexual violence in this horrific massacre. They're alive, but they cannot talk now. And this is, of course, very, it's understandable, of course, because the trauma is horrific. The soul is scarred, and it will take a long, long time, maybe months, maybe even years, till someone will dare to speak about it. And I want to also explain to you that it's like in Israel, you say that you were raped by a Hamas terrorist. It's like people are really embarrassed, maybe feel shamed, feel contaminated. Of course, it's not their fault. It's not the woman's fault, but this is the feeling. Therefore, a woman cannot speak about it right now. I don't know if they could ever really talk about it.
The UN report does talk about the difficulties, the fact that they were not directly able to speak with any survivors, but the report cites exactly what you've talked about the trauma, people not wanting to come forward. You know, the UN has also talked about cases that were highly publicized in Israeli media, but they were not able to confirm. That doesn't negate the realities for all of the other victims, absolutely. But when cases are sensationalized like that, I wonder what kind of impact that has on survivors as they see all of that happening, if that takes away from the very real stories that you're talking about.
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, I don't know if you had a chance to read that, but with the Association of Rape Crisis Centers, which, and we're a very, very credited organization in Israel, we did ourselves a report because we had information coming to us already from the 8th of October about sexual violence. The information came to us from doctors and therapists, not directly from victims, but from doctors and therapists who immediately in the first week already met survivors. And as days passed in Israel, the information we have gotten was bigger and bigger. That's why we decided to do a report, which we called it Silent Cry, and we publicized it 2 weeks ago. And you're talking now about victims. So it's really right what you're saying, because for victims, it's always, you know, in many cases, but what happened here is very extreme, that you suffer from the most horrific thing a human being can even imagine, you know, and now, because they cannot talk, because it's too hard to talk right now, people around the world just can say whatever they say, and the truth is no longer real. You know, I don't know. It's really very hard to deal with that.
what will it take for women, and men who have been victimized, to be able to heal?
Yeah, so it's very hard. Every sexual violence is horrific, you know. But here, it's not only what happened to you. It's all of the world. Everybody is looking for these victims, you know, the survivors. Everybody wants to talk with them. Everybody wants to interview them. There's a huge media pressure. Even this kind of investigation that took place in Israel, Pamela Patton called for survivors to come and speak up. I understand that it was her work. But in my point of view, nobody should speak now unless she has the ability. Mm-hmm. And as I know so many victims, it's too early. So it could take these people a lot of years, these women, really this kind of immense interest to find them and to talk to them. Imagine how one feels, how a woman can feel when everybody could come and speak. How can somebody speak, you know, to say to all the wide world, I was gang raped by Hamas, to acknowledge that it takes a long, long time. I'm sure many people who understand trauma can understand that.
I thank you for your time, Orit.
Thank you.
Orit Salitzianu is the executive director of the Association of Rape Crisis Centers in Israel. She's in Tel Aviv. We can't see methane, but we know it's everywhere. We also know methane is a significant contributor to rising global temperatures and that the fossil fuel industry is one of the biggest emitters. Yesterday, a new satellite called MethaneSat, designed by scientists at the Environmental Defense Fund and Harvard University, was launched into space. And it's considered a big step up in terms of how methane emissions can be tracked all over the world. Mark Brownstein was at the launch site in the Vandenberg Space Force Base in California. He's the Senior Vice President for Energy Transition at the Environmental Defense Fund. We reached him at an airport in Chicago.
Mark, you were at the launch. What was it like?
The launch was spectacular. This is a day that we've been working towards for close to 7 years. And the satellite that we put into space today couldn't be more important and more timely.
You know, when you say it's taken so many years, were you able to exhale finally?
Well, a cheer went up when the satellite finally hit orbit and we finally made contact with it from a relay station in Norway. And that's when we knew that not only had the launch gone successfully, but that the satellite is safely in orbit and doing all the things it's supposed to be doing.
And let's talk about what it's able to do. What is MethaneSat capable of that other satellites have not been able to achieve so far?
So MethaneSat is a tool that's going to allow us to gather information on the methane pollution coming from the global oil and gas industry. This tool will be able to see the methane emissions from over 80% of all oil and gas operations worldwide, including those in Canada. And the reason why that's important is because methane drives nearly a third of the warming that our planet is experiencing right now. So if we can use this information to get the oil and gas industry to reduce its methane pollution, we can actually slow warming on the planet in our lifetime.
And how detailed is the information that it will be collecting for you and to determine where the leaks are?
It has very high sensitivity. So there are some satellites in orbit today that can allow us to see sort of the tip of the iceberg from facilities. This will allow us to see the entire iceberg. And it'll allow us to attribute those emissions back to the specific geographies where the emissions are taking place. It will allow us to determine the rate at which the pollution is coming from the facility. And importantly, it will give us the information that we need in order to be able to go to that country or go to that company, present them with the data, and then be able to work with them to use that data to make reductions and then measure whether or not the company or the country is falling through with what they're supposed to be doing.
Are there particular companies that you're keeping a very close eye on?
Well, you know, we have been doing field studies of methane emissions in the United States, in Canada, in Europe for over 10 years using tools like aircraft and helicopters and drones. So we know that methane pollution from the oil and gas industry is not confined to one country. It's not confined to one company. We see problems everywhere we go. But what we also see is that when companies take action to fix the problems, we can actually see emission reductions. And then it's going to be able to measure how well a company is taking action to reduce emissions. So at the heart of this mission is both data and accountability.
So it will help, you know, keep tabs on governments and companies around the world, Canadian government included in that, to keep them accountable to those targets that they keep promising they'll hit.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the way I sort of look at it and the way I talk about it with companies and policymakers is this is a little bit like having a regular final exam. And if you're a good student, if you're going to all the classes, if you're doing all the homework, if you're doing all the problem sets, you don't worry about the examination at the end of the week. Okay, if you're a student that spends all his time in coffee houses and bars, not attending to business, well, then you're worried. Okay, so I don't have any worry that when companies and countries understand the value of this data to them, that they'll act on it and that they'll show that they really are the A students that they claim to be.
Something that was important to the team was also to make sure this information, this data, would be available to the public. Why was that transparency important?
Well, you know, let's be honest, right? The oil and gas industry has a reputation problem. And there are many companies that have spent many years denying climate science and denying the urgency of the problem. And so civil society is cynical, I think, about both the company's intentions, sometimes about countries' intentions towards this industry. And so giving civil society access to this information is one of the ways in which we address that skepticism.
Is there an economic win potentially for oil and gas companies if they look at your information and use it wisely or do what they're supposed to do?
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, we talk about methane pollution as being a powerful greenhouse gas pollutant. Methane is also the core ingredient in natural gas. And of course, we all know that natural gas is a useful source of energy. So every molecule that we save from being lost in the atmosphere from leaks or flares or venting is one more molecule that can be used to meet energy needs in Canada, energy needs in the United States, energy needs in the rest of the world.
Other satellites, similar satellites, are going to be launched as well. So MethaneSat won't be working entirely on its own. What does that signal to you about tracking greenhouse gases?
I sort of look at the launch of MethaneSat as kind of like the Sputnik moment for climate change, because we now are signaling that there's this new technology out there anybody can use. I mean, we're an environmental NGO. You know, we're not a space agency. We're an environmental NGO. And yet we were able to harness this technology in order to advance the cause of battling climate change. And so I expect, you know, others to follow us on this path.
Thanks for this, Mark.
No, thank you. Really been a pleasure talking with you.
Mark Brownstein is the Senior Vice President for Energy Transition at the Environmental Defense Fund. He's in Chicago. Some U.S. election years, Super Tuesday is the height of political drama. The day 15 states cast their ballots in Republican and Democratic primaries, often determining which candidates will face off in November. It all comes down to this. Sometimes, but not today. This Super Tuesday may prove decisive, but there won't be any surprises. Joe Biden and Donald Trump are guaranteed to win their party's presidential nominations. So one of the only remaining questions is why candidates like Nikki Haley continue to run. But not for Ed Linz. The Virginia man cast his primary vote for Nikki Haley after attending one of her rallies last week. We reached Mr. Linz this afternoon in Springfield, Virginia.
Ed, I know you voted on the weekend, but when you did cast your ballot for Nikki Haley to become Republican nominee, what were you thinking?
Well, I was mostly hoping rather than thinking. And that is, I'm hoping that the Republican nominee will be someone other than Donald Trump.
What do you think the chances of that are?
I don't know, because I can't predict the future. If it goes strictly according to form, Trump will probably gather well more than enough delegates to obtain the nomination. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping that somehow or other the party elders will figure out that this is a recipe for electoral disaster.
Even though the math seems to be, you know, adding up in favor of Donald Trump, what do you want your party and the elders, as you've said, to take away from your vote and others like you who voted for Nikki Haley? What message did you want to send against all odds with your vote?
The message is that Trump will lose the same constituencies that he lost in the previous elections. He has no chance of winning urban women. Neither of my daughters will vote for him, although they're both conservative. I know of no young woman who will vote for him. The message I'm trying to send is that in several states, up to 40% of the people are not enthused about Donald Trump. And the most they can hope to gain from that, in my opinion, is maybe 20% of those voters.
You voted for Donald Trump in the past. How do you feel about those decisions now?
Well, I'm very proud of the fact that I voted. I voted for Trump in 2016 because I wanted a new approach. I voted for him in 2020 because I did not want to vote for Biden. I was not in love with Trump at the time, but I still felt that I could not vote for someone who would not come out of his hole, so to speak, to engage.
How did Ms. Haley change your mind?
Well, Nikki Haley, in my opinion, is a very viable candidate who, if you can believe the polls, would beat Biden head-to-head. I personally am convinced that Biden will not be the Democrat nominee, no matter who is running, but particularly if Trump is running, because Biden is the only Democrat on the face of the earth who can possibly lose to Trump. So
why do you think he's not going to be on the ballot? There's no indication that that's going to happen.
There's plenty of indication among my friends, and I'm talking Democrats also.
Let's stick with Super Tuesday. What about Nikki Haley's policies spoke to you?
I'm not a fan of all of her foreign policies. I'm a little bit worried about some of her bellicose opinions. However, not so much that they're not overridden by her domestic policies, which I like, specifically her fiscal policies, which I think have the best chance of putting the government back on some sustainable mode. Her ideas with respect to how to deal with Congress certainly attract me. I'm very much in favor of her thoughts with respect to the border, and I generally support her very strongly in everything except some of her foreign policy.
You know, we've talked about the math. By tomorrow morning, Trump could have about 1,000 of the 1,215 delegates he needs to win this nomination. Why do you think it's important that Nikki Haley stay in this race?
Well, we need a viable alternative. I would encourage her to stay in all the way up to the convention until Trump is crowned, if indeed that happens.
Do you think she's positioning herself for 2028? Or do you think that she thinks there's still a sliver of hope?
Well, I think there's considerable hope because we don't know what the future is. Mm-hmm. If we look strictly at the delegate count, it certainly looks bleak. But I would encourage her strongly to stay in, and I'll probably send her some money, not a big amount, but I'll send her some money to back up my conviction that we need a existing alternative. 2028 is infinitely far away, and I don't think that she's particularly positioning herself for that. But anyway, I think that, you know, we need an alternative that's out there waiting in case something does happen. And, I mean, you know, Trump could well be in jail by then.
I've spoken to several Republicans in recent weeks who feel the way you do, you know, voted for Trump, not happy with where things went, and are not happy with where the party is going. Why do you think so many other Republicans continue to support Donald Trump when there are other alternatives?
He has what many perceive to be viable, and I might add, easy solutions, quote unquote, to difficult problems. Simply by stating, for example, I'm going to build a wall, and various other things that appeal to a lot of people. And for whatever you can say about Trump, he offers, quote, something very different.
So at the end of the day, if come November, Joe Biden and Donald Trump are the candidates on the ballot, how will you vote?
I will vote for Ed Lenz.
What will that look like, Ed?
Well, I will have one vote, and if I can talk my wife into it, two votes.
You're going to mark yourself on the ballot.
Yes. No, I would write in my name, seriously.
Yeah. What does it say to you that that's where things are at in your country?
Well, you're talking to someone that has voted for such disparate candidates as Goldwater and Kennedy. So I try to vote for whoever I feel at the time is the best candidate among the choices. And between whoever the Democrat is, unless I have somebody other than Trump, I could support some other Republicans also. I just cannot support him.
Ed, thanks for your time.
Okay, bye-bye.
Ed Lenz is a supporter of Republican Nikki Haley. We reached him in Springfield, Virginia. Votes at subcommittees of the International Union of Geological Sciences don't usually get much coverage in the New York Times, but this one was an exception. The committee voted on a proposal that would have officially declared the beginning of a new era of geological time. You may have heard the name for that new era, the Anthropocene. It's been widely used to describe the era in which human impact on the planet has brought about the end of the last era, the Holocene, which stuck around for some 12,000 years. But the committee voted against declaring the beginning of a new era. They were reacting to a proposal that pegged the beginning of the Anthropocene to the mid-20th century, when radioactivity from nuclear bomb tests was released into the world. Earl Ellis is an environmental scientist who agrees with the committee's decision. We reached him in Baltimore.
Earl, walk us through why the committee went this way and decided that, in their view, we are not officially in the Anthropocene era.
So this is basically a decision made by a group of stratigraphers. These are the scientists who study the changes in rocks that define the times in Earth history. And they specifically are looking at the technical elements that are used to define an epoch in what's called the geologic time scale of Earth history. And what they found here is that the proposal that was made by the Anthropocene Working Group did not meet their requirements for what they are looking for in defining an epoch, an Anthropocene epoch in the geologic time scale. So it's a very specific and rather narrow definition of the Anthropocene that was decided by this vote.
You actually resigned in protest from the committee that originally proposed this change. So how do you feel now?
Well, I feel a great sense of relief, honestly, because I was very concerned that this message that the human transformation of the planet, this idea of a human age, is linked just to a single time, 1952, and to this idea that we can understand what people are doing to the planet just with this very narrow, recent timing of the last 70 years. The Anthropocene goes so much deeper than this. So that was really my concern. And so this vote has, in a sense, both validated my concerns and prevented that kind of message from becoming one of the main messages about the human age.
One of the experts who proposed this is the Canadian Francine McCarthy. She proposed this event, nuclear testing, and this location, Crawford Lake, Ontario, as the time and the place where this began. Why do you remain unconvinced?
She's done excellent work. Basically looking at the kinds of timings of different changes in the chemistry of the lake and the biology of the lake, and including this marker for the Anthropocene, this plutonium spike in the sediments. So that work is all perfectly solid geological work. The problem is with the general concept that we can understand and define the human age in terms of this very narrow definition of the since 1950s, basically.
She told the New York Times, "We are in the Anthropocene, and behaving accordingly is our only path forward," end quote. So what would you say to those who agree with her?
I think she's absolutely right. And that defining the Anthropocene so narrowly as just this time since 1952 does not help us achieve this understanding. This understanding requires us to understand that even something like agriculture that is taken as such a, you know, kind of a basic thing in the way the humans are transforming the world is actually part of the challenges of our time. This doesn't all just begin with a big explosion in 1952. We have to look at the Anthropocene as something that has begun long ago when humans began changing the planet, even through things as subtle as just burning the landscape to improve hunting and gathering. There's been so many different forms of changes that have built up over such a long time, and now we have these globalized societies that are, in fact, changing the planet faster than ever. But the most important message is really that human societies can change the planet. And the idea that we can understand this as just an explosion beginning in 1952 really doesn't help us understand just how deep into the Anthropocene we really are.
As you likely know, this term has certainly caught on quite a bit outside the world of science and geology, you know, to illustrate the profound effects humans have had on this planet. I'm thinking of Edward Bertinsky's work, Jennifer Batewell's documentary as well. Many people may have seen that. But beyond that as well, they're not scientists. I concede that, obviously. But do you think it's confusing to have experts tell us we're not in this new epoch now and people wondering, you know, why does this classification really matter? Is it just more academic than practical?
Yeah, I think the important thing here is to realize that this really is an academic matter that was decided by this vote. The Anthropocene lives. It is where we are in Earth history. Everyone should understand that. What's been voted on here is simply this more narrow definition of the Anthropocene as an epoch within the geologic timescale of the International Commission on Stratigraphy. It's not the Anthropocene as a whole that was part of this vote. Merely this particular epoch proposal that was voted on. So no one has to change the way they think about the Anthropocene as a result of this vote.
What do you want our listeners to take away from what the committee has ruled and what you've said so far? What should we do with this information?
I think the most important message of the Anthropocene is not that it has this very specific time or a place where it begins, but really that it's about what all of us can do together to shape a better future. The Anthropocene has just begun. What are we going to do to create a better Anthropocene is the big question here, not when it began.
What's at the top of your list for making it better?
I think the number one thing in terms of urgency, and there's many urgent needs, but I think the number one is that we really have to enforce the responsibility of the corporations and the wealthy nations that are heating this planet up with fossil fuel emissions. It's their responsibility to end these emissions and to support the transition to clean energy for the rest of the world.
Are you concerned that, that already some are pointing to this decision to try to make the case that that human impacts on the environment, climate change in particular, are not as severe as some have warned? Are you worried that, that it's going to be spun this way?
I am worried about that. But all I can do, because, you know, misinformation can come from anywhere. It doesn't require any scientific backing. But I am concerned about that message because we shouldn't get that understanding. And to be clear again, this vote by this committee of geologists has nothing to do with the severity and intensity and ongoing acceleration in climate change that we are causing. It is nothing to do with this. It is only to do with this narrow timing definition and the locational definition in this lake. This is not the definition of the human age itself, which is definitely defined largely, but of course in other ways too, but largely by global climate change caused by human societies.
Earl, thank you.
Hey, my pleasure.
Earl Ellis is an environmental scientist. We reached him in Baltimore. You've been listening to the As It Happens podcast. Our show can be heard Monday to Friday on CBC Radio 1 after Your World Tonight.
And you can, of course, also listen to our show online at cbc.ca/AIH or on the CBC Listen app, or, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.